You're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. A very good morning if you're just after joining us. It's good to have you tuned in. The lines remain open for you, of course, to raise your issues, to make your comments. Yesterday, we had quite a long conversation about cocaine and the view of one addiction counsellor that it is right throughout this community. And it's not going to be undone either, that we have to come up with a different way of approaching the whole situation. But lots of you messaged in, but it's kind of late on the programme, so I had to carry some of them over. Time for a change, a law in this country. Drink and drug use should not be a defence for a crime. For example, in some countries, anyone under the influence who kills someone while driving is automatically charged with vehicular manslaughter. Time to do same here. Are you aware of a new drug going around called monkey dust? It's very dangerous. It can make the user eat glass or jump off high buildings, they say. About time to Ireland has the second highest rate of binge drinking, defined as downing six or more pints at one sitting in Europe after Hungary. You only have to visit rural Donegal at closing time to see the danger this poses on our roads. Let me see. Actually, they're kind of mixed in a little bit here. I'll go through some of the comments on different issues. Aim to average 4% of the first preference votes where they stood. Candidates in the North, good going for a new party, believes that listener. It's their second round of elections, but I take your point. Just found out recently what people in the North refer to the DL on Donegal car reg plates as. Didn't learn. Very apt for the amount of collisions in this county. All right. Hi, Greg. I know of a large guest house that houses Ukrainians, but is moving the Ukrainians out each weekend to other accommodation and selling their rooms to tourists and wedding guests that are attending functions nearby. I'm just wondering, is this allowed, as this is the Ukrainians' home now, essentially? I'm not sure what the terms of the contracts are. The state would be very well aware, I'm sure, if Ukrainians are moving from one piece of accommodation to another. A caller says we need to start to talk to children at school age, i.e. around 10 or 13 years old, about drinking drugs. But there'd be a big pushback on that too. Some people don't like adult topics being taught to children. I wonder, would there be the same resistance to educating children about the do's and don'ts, and mostly don'ts, of course, of drinking drugs at the ages of 10 to 13? Hi, I've been to Portugal twice. The toilets are attended and are spotless. Surely those who are on the dole who have to do community work could do this on a rotating basis. The toilets at Rathmullen are disgusting. I'm not sure really. I don't see why you would, people on social welfare, you'd get them to clean toilets. I mean, there's no harm in that job, but pay people to do it. Greg, my daughters are both celiac. The price of food is terrible. If we weren't so sick eating gluten, I'd be back eating normal food. I can imagine. I don't have any insight into that challenge, but I can imagine. Morning, Greg. No justice for Jasmine, and hard to believe a 2-year prison sentence handed down for attacking an older lady with Alzheimer's in Dublin. I feel sick thinking of what she went through. Thank you. Indeed, I understand exactly where you're coming from. Caller would like to know if anyone has any advice on getting a smart meter installed. Is it a good idea or not? Actually, it's not a bad question, you know. We spoke most recently about people resisting it for whatever reason they might. I don't see the difference in it. They're going to come anyway. I don't see the difference in getting a smart meter or not. As I've said, and I don't want to repeat myself, apologies, I did do some research on the tariffs, and I don't like the tariffs because the electricity is a little bit more expensive in the morning and cheaper at night, but I don't want to put stuff on at night. So the meter in and of itself, I don't see any issue with it. At the moment, I don't see any advantage to it either. But listen, you're out there. You've got them. Okay, you are very welcome back to the programme, and we welcome on to it now Gerry Adams, the former Sinn Féin president and author of Councillor Eddie Fullerton, Visionary, Patriot and Martyr. Good morning, Gerry. Thanks for your time today.
Imagine my Greg, how are you?
Good. Getting you loud and clear. Thank you very much for joining us. Okay, you're going to launch this book at the Lake of Shadows Hotel in Buncrana tomorrow night at 7 p.m. What approach did you take to this book, Gerry? Other than the obvious, what story did you want to tell?
Well, first of all, I wanted to pay tribute to Eddie's family by recollecting my acquaintance with him, my friendship with Eddie over the years. You know, he was a a larger than life figure in many ways. Big grizzly beard on him, big mop of hair, full of crack, immensely popular, but also an anamkara to Dana and a loving father to their six children, and a good friend and a comrade and a good neighbour to all the people who knew him, and proud Donegal man, proud Irishman, and like many. Away he went to England for work. I think he may have went to Scotland first. So, and then into Birmingham, where he was followed by his many brothers. I also wanted to tell the story of his family roots in Inishowen. You know, it's a beautiful peninsula. And I mean, I first got to know Eddie extra well away back in 1984. I was shot and was provided with the use of a caravan through Martin McGuinness, who had a friend who had a mobile home up there just outside. So myself and my wife clattened up there, and we were there for a lot of weeks. I was just recovering. So Eddie and his old friend Jim Ferry, Raymond McLaughlin and his wife Mary were in and out, just making sure that everything was okay and we were looked after. And he also brought me around parts of Inishowen, showed me where Wolf Tone had landed, showed me up where the family homestead was. So, as I say, I got to know him better in that period. So I wanted to tell that story. And then, of course, there's the story of his killing and the ongoing campaign by the family all these years later. They know the truth. They know what happened. The recent ombudsman's report last year, Marie Anderson, Operation Greenish, said that British state forces were involved with UDA and other loyalist paramilitaries, that the weapon came in from South Africa, that as many as, I suppose, the figure I have here is 19 people were killed and many, many more were injured. So it's telling that story. This is the book, Greg.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, is a photograph of Eddie. He went down on a delegation on behalf of the people of Donegal, and the government minister wouldn't meet him and wouldn't meet the delegation. And Eddie, who loved his constituents, withdrew from the delegation because he didn't want the opportunity of a meeting on their behalf to be missed because of the stupidity and arrogance of the minister.
And the party in Donegal has come on, of course, since 1979. Eddie was the first Sinn Féin member to be elected. Now numerous, obviously, councillors within the party, in Padraig McLaughlin and Piers Doherty, two of the most senior members of the Sinn Féin in the Republic. But it all started with Mr. Fullerton.
Yes, Eddie was... Pat Doherty tells that there was no structure up in Inishowen. You know, there was a structure throughout the rest of the county. And when Eddie came back from Birmingham, and he'd been active in Birmingham on Irish issues, particularly on behalf of the prisoners, and he had raised the flags there. He was there during, you know, the hunger strikes that took place at that time and the prisons in England. So when he came back, he became a vocal point. He became a hub, if I can use that term. He sold more on Foblocked than anyone else. And he did it just physically, did it just by going out and around pubs and up and down streets and so on. So he established a structure, and as you say, quite rightly, when he stood for the election, he topped the poll. He was immensely popular. And then that example has been taken up by other younger people. Eddie, unfortunately, didn't live long enough to see the success of the party in Donegal or to see the peace and the Good Friday Agreement, but he would have been a huge supporter of all of those. Padraig McLaughlin will be there tomorrow night speaking. Amanda Ferguson, one of Eddie's daughters, will be there also on behalf of the family. And Piers Doherty will be there too. And, you know, it's important in my view anyway, this is a little series of books that I've undertaken. I think it's important to tell our own story. And, you know, and everybody has a right to tell the story. And it's when you put all the narratives down, you know, side by side, then you get a sense of the whole history. So this is an attempt to make sure that Eddie Fullerton's story and the story of his wife and his family is told.
Do you remember being told of his murder?
Yes. It was at a time in that period, a large number of people involved with Sinn Féin, members or our family members, were killed. 21 Sinn Féin members were killed. So we were living in that type of atmosphere. But no one had been killed in the South. And Eddie was also a high-profile public official. There are big questions about how elements of an Garda Síochána handled the investigation. I mean, they spread rumours that he was shot by Republicans. They spread all sorts of silly nonsense, which brought great agony to the family and outrage among his friends. Of course, when I got the news, I was shocked. But because of the time we were living in, nothing really shocked you. You know, I was shocked at a personal level. I wasn't shocked at a political level. And if you consider that the British now are bringing through this shameful bill, which is trying to destroy the element of the Good Friday Agreement and other agreements, which try to deal with the issue of victims. And victims is a very general term, so it isn't one set of victims, it's for all the victims. And Eddie's case is exactly the reason why they're doing that. If you consider now, the ombudsman found that British state forces were involved in the killing of a county councillor from Donegal. That's why the British are trying to get rid of the different processes which were agreed at the Stormont House Agreement to give the families whatever succour can be given, whatever truth. And that's why, you know, the family are so valiant, like many, many other families who are in a similar position in pursuing their campaign. And I do think there's a huge onus on the Irish government. The Irish government is a co-guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement. It's very, very clear. They cannot be junior partners. The Irish government has a responsibility towards the Fullerton family and everybody else to uphold the rights under the agreement that people voted for. The people north and south, it's the people's agreement. Mm-hmm. So the Irish government have a responsibility to raise this issue. And Mary Lou MacDonald and others, Padraig and Pearce, have raised it in the Dáil. And I am not at all satisfied that the Irish government is doing enough to get the British government to resign, to back off from trying to drive another coach and horses through the Good Friday Agreement.
You know, as you reflect on, you know, the sense of personal loss when you heard that news, and as you quite rightly pointed out, you know, everyone has their stories, and people from all different backgrounds lost their lives during the Troubles. It's a further reminder how imperative it is that we never allow ourselves to slide back anywhere close to those times. Do you have concerns? Obviously, there is a political vacuum at the moment in Northern Ireland. It doesn't seem much is going to change, even post the local elections in which Sinn Féin did very, very well. Do you have concerns as to where we are at now and where we potentially are going?
Well, I don't think we can ever take the peace for granted. So we have to keep nurturing it. We have to keep working on it. But I and I'm always afraid to say this in case something dastardly happens, but I don't see there being any possibility of there being any return to violence. I just can't see that. There are small groups, and they should just go away. You know, and I'm actually willing, and others are willing to go and talk to them. You know, if they present themselves as Republican, Well, there now is a method, a peaceful democratic method to end the union with Britain, and the people will have their say on that. So I don't have other than just, you know, being cautious, concerns that we're going to slip back. The war is definitely and absolutely over. There is a vacuum. I don't think that Geoffrey Donaldson has any option other than to go back into Stormont. I think he knows that. Michelle O'Neill is a first minister for all. She's a first minister designate now. That changed with the electorate in the last local government election. And there's also very, very clearly a pro-Irish unity vote in the vote for Sinn Féin. So I think we need to be, again, getting the Irish government to do the preparatory work for the time ahead. Mm. You know, we wouldn't be doing this interview if you hadn't planned it. So
yeah.
You have to plan.
Indeed. Do you think finally, and I won't hold you very much longer, do you think the DUP resistance to going into government is to do with the fallout from Brexit, or is it that they perhaps can't imagine themselves playing effectively what would be seen as second fiddle to Michelle O'Neill and Sinn Féin?
Well, they're looking for concessions from the British government on Brexit issues and on the Windsor Protocol and all the rest of that. And I don't think any sensible person would have any problem with them being given some, you know, practical concessions which don't undermine the principle of what has been agreed. I have no doubt that some within the DUP are resiling from the fact that Michelle O'Neill will be the First Minister. I don't think Geoffrey Donaldson is one of those. I believe him when he says it is, you know, that's not stopping him. He just needs to make sure he doesn't over-negotiate, overplay his hand. And I also, as I said previously there, we need a date. We don't need a referendum tomorrow or the next day, but we need a date for the referendum. And we need a citizens' assembly organised by the Irish government to discuss all these matters. And everybody should be part of it. And we clearly need Northern Protestants to be very, very much front and centre of that. The union is tactically made not engage at this stage. So all of that work's to be done in the time ahead. And, you know, just to say this, the island wouldn't be, and Sinn Féin certainly wouldn't be, where we are today if it wasn't for the sacrifice of men like Addie Fullerton and the sacrifice of his family.
Yes, for sure. And that book will be launched in the Lake of Shadows Hotel in Buncrana tomorrow night, May 25th at 7 p.m. Very finally, on a much lighter note, of course, we've nothing to talk about anymore because we've a Northern Irishman in Patrick Kilty taking over the Late Late Show. So I'm going to ask the question that you've been asked a million times now. Are you enjoying your book writing and you somewhat step out of the limelight? Or are we? Would you be interested in and honoured to hold the position as President of Ireland, Gerry?
Well, first of all, I wish Patrick Kilty well. He's a very clever, smart and funny man. And that's a big position he's coming into. And he's from County Down as well for his sins. it's an honour to represent Sinn Féin in any position whatsoever. But I'm done with public office. I keep getting asked this question when I stand for the presidency. The answer is a good Ulster word, no. I will not stand for the presidency. I'm content with a great leadership in the party. I'm content doing what I'm doing. And I just hope that people from the Northwest and from Inishowen particularly will turn out tomorrow night in solidarity with the Fullerton family.
Excellent. And as I say,
Greg, thank you for this.
And that is the important element. I'll remind people now. Thank you very much indeed, Gerry Adams. Have a lovely day.
Okay,
take care of yourself. Bye-bye. So that's Gerry Adams, former Sinn Féin president, author of Councillor Addie Fullerton, Visionary, Patriot and Martyr. And as you heard, it's a significant event taking place in the Lake of Shadows Hotel in Buncrana tomorrow night, Thursday, May 25th at 7 p.m. And you heard categorically that Gerry Adams has no interest in being the president of Ireland, because I've read some speculation about it as recently as 3 or 4 weeks ago. He's probably answered that question a million times already. But anyway, for the listeners here in the Northwest, there you have it. Now, more regularly than you would want, we get correspondence from parents and by the time and guardians, and by the time they contact us, they're at their wit's end, and it's on the issue of bullying. And there's nothing worse. Many of you out there would have had a child that's come home with a once-off bullying incident, or they've had a bad experience at school and then, you know, they're upset going to school the next morning. I know many of you out there, moms and dads, grands and granddads, aunts and uncles, understand exactly what I'm talking about. It's heartbreaking. And I also know, because I've spoken to people on this programme well into their 50s, 60s and beyond, who experienced bullying at school, and it shaped their life and affects them still. And they would become upset talking back to what happened to them as young people, and it's affected their relationships and what have you as they went through life. And I'm not overstating it here, because I know I've spoken to them. Now, we received, and we have to be somewhat general, we received an email correspondence recently, and it outlines what one family is going through and how they've tried to deal with it. They talk about a series of bullying incidents, the latest incidents involving our son and another pupil while in your care during school hours, and we wish to put it on record how disappointed we are in the manner with which the school has yet again failed to deal with the ongoing issue. After 2 years, it's quite clearly bullying. So this is a letter to the local school talking of bullying that's been going on for 2 years, and they feel that something is not being done. Now, we can't speak in this instance about individual cases, but we can speak in the general. Mary Dunn is founder of the National Association for Victims of Bullying. Thanks for joining us, Mary.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning.
And as I say, Mary, and you can perhaps articulate it better than I, bullying is horrendous and has a really, really strong impact on children and, of course, those around them then.
It does. And the whole family is affected, the grandparents, and as you said, anybody who can remember going to school and it happening to them, it brings it all back. But the sad thing is, who do not have an anti-bullying policy, may not have any code of procedures whatsoever. What I would say to parents is the Department of Education have available to parents to download the anti-bullying policy if your school doesn't have one. You actually can have one from the department. But also the awareness that your child is struggling every day to survive. It's basic survival within the school environment when bullying is going on. They have to plan how to escape the bully, how to stay safe. And if teachers are not supervising in the yard can be a problem. The toilets, anywhere can be a problem for a child. And what I say to teachers every day, there are simple questions you ask the student. Where is it happening? How is it happening? And what can we do to stop it? And I have spoken to several children who tell me what they know can be done to stop it. So it's a simple situation. It should never run on for weeks. Once a parent noticed and brings it to the attention of the school, if both cooperate, it will stop.
Okay, well, Mary, it should be the case. But we'll fast forward to a situation where parents are back and forth with the school. The problem is ongoing and they aren't satisfied. There's physical abuse, there's mental abuse. What responsibility does the school have? In other words, we're having to talk about this point, perhaps, of escalating the issue. What is the responsibility of the school? What can a parent expect once they contact the school and outline exactly what is going on?
Well, I suppose the first thing you expect for any child going into a school, that they're going to be safe. And under the Health and Safety Act, if a child is being bullied and beaten in a school, then that is against the law. And the Gardaí should be involved, plus the Board of Management. Know your Board of Management. Know who is the chairperson. Know who your two parent reps on that Board of Management are. Know how you can approach the school. There's a lot of bodies involved in stopping the bullying. It's not just down to one teacher. It is the cooperation of both the principal, the Board of Management, the parents of both children. Because the effect of being named a bully has just as much an effect as being bullied. So both children have to be taken care of.
Yeah, but if you aren't satisfied, can you? You've gone to the board of management. You've gone to the school. Where's your next port of call? Is it the education department? If there's an overarching body.
Well, the Department of Education is solely responsible, so you can make a call to them. But in actual fact, sometimes talking to the individual who's been bullied, they may ask to be taken out of the school. Now, for some kids to be taken out of the school, it's victimizing them again. But for some children, they will say to me, I'm not going back there anymore. I don't trust them. This has been going on for a year. They have done nothing to protect me. So take me out of the school.
Yes, but often, Mary, that happens because the bully, we can't use names, right? So I'm going to have to use these terms, that sometimes the bully remains in the class and that child might be have to see that other child every day, play sports with them, you know, and, you know, the little looks and the little threatening mannerisms that can go on. You know, what is the protocol for removing the bully from the situation? Why should it be the victim?
Well, you see, if the victim asks to leave, then yes, you have to consider what the victim is asking. But if the victim is insisting that they want to stay in the school, be with their friends, why should they leave? They're not at fault. Then what the parent has to do is sit down with the principal of the school and the teacher, whoever it may be, or at second level, it can be a group of teachers and the year head that's involved, whichever the situation. You want a guarantee from those people that your child is safe to go into the school. If you don't get that guarantee and you can't trust that environment, then it leaves you with no choice but to put your child first. And that's where the child will have to understand it's for their good. Mm. They're trying to survive in an environment. But a lot of good teachers out there will listen, will do their best, and we always come back to the parents and say, we're doing such a thing. Is Charlie or Johnny or whoever happy with what we're doing? Do they want us to change what we're doing? So the cooperation between the school, the parent and the pupil, that's where it's solved, Greg.
Mm. Now, I mean, some schools are brilliant at this. And nip it in the bud. And, you know, they're very proactive. I can't understand why all schools aren't, because as soon as it continues for a period of time, then you're dealing with at least two groups of parents. And then you're starting to deal with maybe students having to be moved out of classes or whatever it might be. It's a nightmare for any school and its management. Why is there not a consistent policy that is enforced and checked like HICWA does a hospital? Why is there not a, you know, strict rules to ensure that every school can demonstrate their anti-bullying policies and processes? Because it's so important, it shouldn't be hit and miss.
Well, if I say this to you, Greg, in 35 years of doing this job, I would still say to you that schools do ignore the department. And a lot of parents, rather than bring the issue or have anybody know what's going on, will not report the school. And this is where we find that if the schools cooperate with the parents, the value of that school goes so high, the parents appreciate what's been done. But when we have schools who ignore and deny that bullying is taking place, we know schools say, oh, well, that doesn't happen in my school. And then they're surprised when I ring them and say, it is happening in your school. And this is how I'm advising you to deal with it. So if teachers and principals, boards of management and the parents come together and insist that there is a policy, know the rules and regulations, it's written in the school journal. Every student takes their journal home. The parents read it and sign it. Then they become part of that policy. But a lot of parents don't realise that they have the right to ask for that policy, to ask what's the guidelines and procedures, and ask for a copy. They're not, your parents are not doing it. And if parents did it and were aware of what to ask, then schools wouldn't be getting away with it.
And if you get that, if you're still not content, don't let it rumble on. Go in or contact the head of the school and say, I'm unsatisfied with how you're dealing with this. I am now making a formal complaint to the Department of Education. Is that how people should progress?
Exactly, Greg. And the most important thing is to ask the victim, what's going on? Have your facts before you do any meetings. Ask the victim, where is this happening? Who? How? And where are you safe? If you're not safe in the yard, then the parent has the right to go in and say, is the yard being supervised? Are you aware that my child has been beaten up in your yard? So you bring all that information into the school. You don't leave them anyway with in any doubt of what's going on. You go in well prepared and you ask for the code of behaviour, the anti-bullying policy and the guidelines and procedures. That's your right as a parent.
You say that sometimes you advocate on behalf of people. What point would you, Mary, become involved in the situation? Is it after someone has contacted the Department of Education? Is it part of the process? What is the reaction when the founder of the National Association for Victims of Bullying contacts the school?
On the parent and the principal's agreement, the parent will talk to the principal. If the principal needs advice or needs to talk to me at any stage, yes. I only on the permission of the parent.
And what do principals say when you say, look, it's Mary Dunn here?
I don't have, I don't think I've ever had a problem, Greg. I think a lot of principals and teachers who get in touch with me would be more interested in how to help the parent and how to sort out the situation. So there's no objection by any principal or any school or any board of management to talking to me because they need that maybe things that they were trying to fix, they were going about it the wrong way. So if they're open to learning how to deal with the situation, then I'm here 24/7.
But it should not be allowed to persist. It should not be allowed to go on for 6 months, a year, 2 months.
There's no excuse if it goes beyond 2 weeks.
Right. So we as parents have to get tough then.
Yes, you do, Greg. Yes, you do. And I've been saying that to parents at parents' meetings around the country. You've got to ask the proper questions. You've got to be informed.
Yes.
You've got to know your rights.
Yeah, and I'm not saying not doing that is any form of weakness, but we tend not to want to upset the apple cart. But we have to. We have to bang the drum. We have to use the right language. We have to make the right demands in terms of policy and procedures. We have to demand what action plan is taking place. And if that doesn't work, we have to contact the Department of Education and tell the school that you're making a formal complaint and you're going to make this very difficult for them, and also engage the services of the likes of yourself. I mean, that's what we have to do here, because I'm seeing some notes that young children write in the depths of what they're feeling. Yep. And I'm looking at pictures of victims of a victim of bullying that we were contacted about, and you can see the sadness in the eyes. The eyes, I often think, you know, tell us so much, and the little notes, it's just heartbreaking. It can't be allowed to go on, Mary.
Well, can I give you an insight to what children suffer, Greg?
Please.
Their sleeping patterns, the constant pain, or the silence. The other thing is what a lot of parents think they know. When a child gets up in the morning, the bully is actually in their head. They go into school and they have to survive, because that's what it is. It's survival. It's not learning. It's interfering with the learning. They can't pay attention because they don't know where the bully is going to attack them. And if it's a group, it's very hard to avoid a group. So there's so many issues out there, Greg, even to spend hours discussing them. There's so many situations that the children and young people, and even in colleges, even in the workplace, your day is spent trying to avoid a situation where you know they're going to get you. So you can't learn.
No, and the worst,
you can't do your day's work.
Yeah, and the worst thing now too, with the online element of it, it doesn't end at the school gates or begin at the school gates anymore. It can It can, it can continue on the phones and what have you. Okay, Mary Dawn. Go ahead.
Sorry, can I just say to people, if you're wondering, phone, and even now parents ring me and say, should I buy a phone for an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old? I say to parents, do you know how to use your phone? Are you up to date with technology? Are you going to take that phone at nighttime? Are you going to allow that phone to be brought up to the bedroom? Are you in charge of this instrument that you're going to give your child? And I say, would you give your child the keys to your car?
Let me put one comment here to you before I let you go, if that's okay. Why do experts always assume that only one child is being bullied? I'm not saying you did, Mary. I'll read on here, though. If you take the victim out of the school, the bully still has other children to victimise. Mary's talking a lot about what is correct procedure, but very little assistance on what to do when the school fails to deal with the situation to the satisfaction of the child being bullied. I think involving the Gardaí should also be an option. You've said it is a crime if it's ongoing. But yes, the advice you did give is if the school is failing to deal with the situation, contact the Gardaí. They won't want to see the Gardaí landing, but contact, go into the principal, say that I'm raising this issue with the Department of Education and keep at them until such time as you feel the situation is being resolved. Is that the solution?
It's not always the solution, Greg, and it's what I said. We have to listen to the victim. And a lot of parents feel that, well, I can't take him out of school or I can't take her out of school. But if the child is insisting that they can't go back to that school, then the school has failed the child.
Yes, but the point was making, that bully is still in the school and that bully may go on to victimise other children. I know you have to look after your own child, but...
You have made the school aware. If another family are going to go through what you've been through, then the accumulation of information, then what I say is that school has failed every student. And schools have pride in their work. Teachers have pride. So if you have a good principal, good teachers, boards of management, all coming together to work with parents, the school will be safe.
That's providing if they don't all circle the wagons, though, and say, hold on, yeah, this is a fantastic school we have. There's no bullying going on here. It's your child that's doing this, that and the other. You see, I'm trying to come up with solutions. I know people have gone through that, and I'm trying to come up with some sort of a strategy or solution to help people whereby those wagons have been circled.
Yes, and the sad thing is, Greg, we have parents who basically give up. Like, there's so many situations, it's not...
Okay, we've lost that connection to Mary. Mary Dawn, founder of the National Association for Victims of Bullying, thank you very much for your time, and I think we covered most of the issues there. Not to everyone's satisfaction, but it's a very, very complex complex situation, and there isn't a single answer because all cases, all schools and all individuals seemingly are different, but hopefully that was constructive for some people listening this morning. All right, Wellness Wednesday on the way, coming up after 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for that. Kieran O'Donnell will join us as well with some business news and to preview Highland Radio's Business Matters podcast. This caller says, though, as a parent, I think phones should be banned totally from school grounds. Bullying happens so much via phones and social media under false names, but it's parents who need to take control. Another, on the issue of drugs, a caller says that young people have nowhere to go anymore. Even the pub, the cost of a pint has gone up so much that they can no longer afford it. And I think, too, there should be more facilities right across the county and region where it doesn't involve booze or drink. You know, with the disappointment recently in the south of the county of a cinema not going ahead, which would have been a lovely outlet for young people, though it's not incredibly inexpensive to go to the cinema anymore. But you know what I mean? Something else to do that doesn't involve alcohol. What's being done about the speed of traffic travelling the Burnfoot to Muff Road? 80 kilometres limit to traffic. Traffic travelling a lot faster. Also overtaking on solid white lines. A few cars that have overtook me must have been travelling well over 100 kilometres in the 80 kilometre zone. It is a difficult one, isn't it? Because I think drivers often ignore speed signs and are conditioned to drive at 100, and that's what's happening there. I'm not sure about what enforcement is happening, if any, but clearly not enough, you would say. And I was passing the school, oh, what's the name of the school? Caroline's away. The school on the Lifford, the Letterkenny to Derry Road. We talked about it to a Colin and another gentleman at that time. It'll come to me anyway. But they were talking about a speed sign, a temporary speed limit sign, when you're coming from the direction of Derry that doesn't give you enough time to stop. Now, obviously, I was sitting here in the studio and trying to put counterpoints and what have you and have a broader discussion on it. Caroline, what's the name of that school again on the side of the road there? Mullock Dirk? Maharabeg. Okay, Maharabeg. So I was coming back from the Bridge End direction yesterday and come around the corner, and the temporary speed sign was on, and wow, you do not have any time to stop. It is really, really dangerous. I just wanted to say that because I was kind of putting up counter arguments to Colin and our other guest. They need to do something about that really, really seriously, because you come around the corner, that light's flashing, and you have to slam on your brakes. And I was only doing about 85, maybe 90 at a stretch, and I had to slam my brakes on. Car got very big behind me all of a sudden. And you have to stop. There's not enough time to do so. So they really, really need to look at that. And I have a much better understanding, having seen it myself now. And also add into that the Bisa speed van in that temporary speed limit. So you really do have to stand on the brakes. And it comes at you. You don't know exactly where the school's at. So again, definitely, I've experienced it now, and I would agree. Also, I noticed coming up, and sorry to talk about roads I'm on. I want you to get involved with where you're at. Coming up the left-hand lane out of Letterkenny up towards the school at the top of the Bray there, that sign's obscured. The temporary speed limit is obscured. Limit sign is obscured until you're right up on top of it. So that's just two examples whereby drivers aren't even getting half a chance to know when that sign's on and to adjust their speed accordingly. Because if you're coming up that hill and there's an Arctic behind you, you slow down quickly. It's a big complication for the articulated driver as well. So both of those signs are A, one's in the wrong place, and B, the other is obscured by branches. You cannot see the sign as you head up towards that school there. So as I say, you know, drivers need to be given a fair crack of the whip too.